And you're listening to Beneath the Surface on KPFK Los Angeles, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California. I'm Susie Wiseman, and I'm very pleased to have my friend Kevin Anderson joining me in studio today. Kevin is a professor of political science at Purdue University in Lafayette, Indiana. That's near Chicago. Yeah. And he's the author of Lenin, Hegel, and Western Marxism, the co-editor of the ongoing Collected Works of Marx and Engels, which is just a giant project. And he also has brought out, and we talked about on this show, Marx on Suicide, among many other works.
3 years ago.
Right. And Kevin today comes to us to discuss a new book that I hope all of you just run out and buy, and I'm really that enthusiastic about it. It's the Rosa Luxemburg Reader, and some of you may remember who Rosa Luxemburg was, but if you don't, you will now. So she is, in fact, Rosa Luxemburg, one of the leaders of the failed German Revolution of 1918, a Polish-Jewish Marxist of considerable erudition and talent as a speaker, as a writer, as an original thinker, a polemicist, and an organizer. She was murdered in 1919 by the Social Democratic government of Ebert Noski and battered to death with a revolver butt in January 1919 by German officers along with Karl Liebknecht. They were, if you like, the Lenin and Trotsky of the German Revolution. And her execution, and their execution, I should say, without trial, effectively decapitated the revolution, which then sputtered on in fits and starts until 1923. It has been speculated, had they not been killed, there may not have been a Hitler, and the century just may have been spared the nightmare that we are still, or we still have not overcome. She was the only figure in Western socialism capable of equaling or perhaps surpassing the Russian revolutionaries in terms of intelligence and the spirit of freedom, and her enemies really understood this well, and that's why she was murdered. And I should just say, there was a film done about Rosa Luxemburg in the late 70s. Kevin, I'm going to let you talk in a second. One of the things that I thought about that film was, while I was glad to see it, it kind of portrayed her as a pacifist feminist. But she was so much more. And Kevin Anderson and Peter Hudis show that in their new book, The Rosa Luxemburg Reader. It's just published by Monthly Review Press. It has a lot that is new in it that's never been seen before. And we're going to talk about it for the next, let's say, 25 minutes or so. I should just say, Peter Hudis is a co-editor. He's not with us today. He's an organizer and has also published many books. So welcome after all of that.
Thanks.
Kevin.
It's great to be here, Susie.
Well, it's great to have you back. And of course, Rosa Luxemburg is one of the major figures of our time. And I think I'm really glad you're doing this because I think she's one of the thinkers, revolutionary thinkers of this century, who I would say, along with Victor Serge and a few others, have to be rescued for the following century or for the century that we're just beginning.
Well, that was our idea in publishing the book, that this is a socialist thinker, revolutionary thinker, feminist thinker in a way that speaks to the 21st century. And what we have here is something unusual in the sense that a lot of times what we're doing is discovering or rediscovering women thinkers who were relatively obscure in their own time but need to be read today. This is not one of those cases. This is more like the female astronauts who were there, very important in their own time, and then forgotten. I mean, it's not that Rosa Luxemburg has been completely forgotten, but as you mentioned those other names, Lenin and Trotsky, they're a lot better known today, whereas in her own lifetime, certainly for the greater part of her lifetime, Luxemburg was actually better known than either of them.
Right. And you mentioned at the very, I think it's in the introduction of the book, that in 2003, on the 81st anniversary of their assassination, Karl and Rosa, that there was a mass demonstration in Berlin. And you point out that she's seen as an anti-militarist or an internationalist. We all know, or those of us who've read her know, that she was opposed to World War I. And that was also highlighted in the film about her. But it seems that she is slighted when she's thought of as mainly an anti-war figure. And I wondered what you think, because you go in this book into her critique of globalized capitalism and imperialism and her concern with more than just the advanced industrial societies. What do you say in the book, and what did you find?
Well, this is someone who very early on perceived the importance of the question of war and militarism in Europe. I mean, this is someone who starts becoming prominent around 100 years ago. Her first major publication is 1899, Reform or Revolution. And one of the reasons that she thinks capitalism is not reformable, not humanizable in the ultimate sense, is not the usual economic arguments only, which a lot of Marxists were making and socialists, but she saw a war on the horizon in Europe. She was one of the few thinkers who was very worried and concerned about the military buildups that were occurring in Germany, England, France, and so forth, and that there really could be a war in Europe, whereas 100 years ago, many, many thinkers, even radical ones, thought that peace and prosperity would continue indefinitely. You know, a little like that feeling that there was around after the Berlin Wall fell, that, well, now Russia was gone. And so
the end of history.
There was a little bit of that feeling. Fin de siècle was called the end of the 19th century. And there was a feeling that peace and progress would just continue in an evolutionary manner.
Well, but she, you know, was anti-imperialist, a socialist, and as a socialist, a democratic one, not a social democrat, but one who believed that democracy and socialism were inseparable. And she was also really disgusted with the resolution-passing, stuffy, bureaucratic social democrats of her time. One of the things that she is known for saying is liberty is only liberty when it is secured for one's enemies. Not what we usually think about when we think of revolutionary socialists, or at least what has been propagandized. Are these ideas what's kept her marginalized?
Probably to a great extent. In other words, this is someone who doesn't fit into the categories easily. No, she's not a traditional communist in the sense, I mean, she was the major leader at the time the German Communist Party was founded. But a couple years later, after her death, her writings critical of Lenin and Trotsky were found, where she says exactly what you just quoted, that freedom is for the one who thinks differently, liberty, freedom.
Yeah.
And this is a critique of the Russian Revolution, which she supported. She supported the idea of a second radical socialist revolution in Russia, but she opposed the idea of setting up a single-party state, and right from the beginning. And that was when—and she was in prison. She was in a capitalist prison of the German state at the time that she wrote that, from prison.
And she spent a lot of her time in prison, didn't she?
Well, there were at least—there were two major periods in prison, one after the Russian Revolution of 1905, which she participated in, and she was locked up for a while. And then she was jailed for almost the entirety of World War I. She and Karl Liebknecht were the two most famous opponents of World War I in Germany. And she was locked up almost the day the war started and kept in jail until the day the war ended. November 11th, which the U.S. celebrates as Armistice Day, is the day that the prisons were broken open and Luxembourg was broken out, actually by anti-war soldiers and workers.
I'm speaking with Kevin Anderson. He is the co-author of the Rosa Luxemburg Reader. It's published just now by Monthly Review Press, and you can get it at your favorite bookstore, online bookseller. It includes so much about Rosa and so many of her writings that you can't get in any other place, and things that have never appeared before as well. And I just want to pick up, Kevin, on one of the things that you said about her disputes with Lenin and the Russian Revolution, her on the notion of the party that's very much tied up with this crucial question of democracy, of grassroots movements from below, even perhaps her ideas of the mass strike. And I wondered if we could just go through some of those disputes.
Sure.
Okay, now I know we're not going to be able to do real justice in a short radio interview, but what did she think of Lenin's party And I should just say that many people would say that the Bolsheviks created the instrument that allowed them to come to power, which was their party. But as soon as they came to power, it revealed all of its, let's say, less positive aspects.
Okay, Luxembourg was part of a small Polish party, and Polish Socialist Party, which was a wing of the larger Russian Social Democratic Party, because the Bolsheviks, the Mensheviks, Luxembourg's Polish Party, were all part of this, and they had their different arguments and so forth. And one of the things we've translated for the first time is a critique of Lenin. There's two others that are better known, one from 1904 and then the one we were just referring to from 1918. But there's a 1911 critique that was actually hidden in the Russian archives for many, many years and wasn't published till about a decade ago. This one is interesting because she slams Lenin, calls him an ultra-centralist and all this kind of thing. But she also actually attacks the other more reformist Russian leaders as well as Trotsky much more sharply than she attacks Lenin. So it's a very complex relationship with Lenin. At one point in this essay, she says that his group is the best group of the various Russian groups, but they have this one little problem, which is that they're centralist and bureaucratic and what we call today vanguardist.
Right. And so what does she say about Trotsky, and what does she say, you know, to counter that, apart from just criticizing?
Well, Trotsky and some of the others she views as just much more involved in, like, ordinary politics of, like, wheeling and dealing and so forth.
Is that administrative zeal?
Well, but just in this case, it's not. That's the thing that he's criticized for later. But in this case, it's more just trying to play various sides of the question. Trotsky didn't distinguish himself from the reformist socialist as sharply until a little bit later, whereas Luxembourg was actually ahead of Lenin in seeing through the reformists at a time when Lenin had good relations with Kautsky and the leaders of the German Social Democrats. Luxembourg gets into a huge dispute in 1910 and 11.
Oh, and her words are just so sharp.
Because what they basically do is kind of, well, I mean, I think it's happened in other parties more recently, but they say since we don't want to offend the pro-war voters, so we won't really make our anti-war position like too blatant during the campaign. That's what they basically did, and she got into a huge fight with them because she published what we're supposed to referred to what were internal party discussions where they had said this, you know, and people just blew up after.
She also argued with Lenin on the national question, and this is a huge issue of our time still, you know, the question of not just national self-determination, but the place of nationalism.
Yeah, and this is a debate that speaks to us today, too, I think, because we have kind of two images of globalization. One is that we're all going to be eating out of McDonald's all over the world, and everything's going to be the same, and there's going to be labor or civic movements against, well, the empire, I mean, Negri and Harder. There's different ways of talking about it. But then the other way is that there will be, like, localized resistance, and that some of that resistance will take the form of states and peoples and ethnic groups seeking autonomy or self-determination or even independence. Luxembourg was part of that school that said those kind of things, talking about national independence in an interdependent, already very globalized world, is like talking like going back to small-scale competitive capitalism after you've reached monopoly and centralization. She just thought that was like over with. And she probably was, I mean, some would agree with her today, but very few would agree with her completely because, for instance, she opposed the independence of Poland.
Most of the Poles would disagree.
Yeah. She didn't think that India should fight for its independence.
Victor Serge was with her on that.
Really?
Yeah. Because he believed that in an era of death, in an era of Stalinist totalitarianism, that each of these national liberation struggles would only be Stalinized and create imitations of the Stalinized, you know, Soviet Union. So it would not really be better.
And her claim was similar, I mean, that before this phenomenon had come in, but in other words, that it would just be replacing an indigenous bourgeoisie or corrupt ruling class with, they would replace what had gone before, and it wouldn't be significantly different for most people in the society.
Well, this makes her a true internationalist.
That's what it is. It's really, I mean, people talk about Marxism as an international phenomenon, but in fact, most of them were rooted in a particular country. This is someone who was in exile from the Russian Empire, part of an exile movement, a major leader of one, yet she became a German citizen, and she's just as much a participant in the German movement, and even in a sense, the French movement a little bit. And a lot of the Germans didn't even know what she was doing in Poland and Russia.
And there's two things about that, Kevin. One is that she's Jewish, and the other is that, you know, we seem to not remember that so much of Eastern and Central Europe was of mixed heritage and mixed ethnicity,
exactly.
And that's really what made it, you know, with those empires and at the end of the, you know, now we think of as Yugoslavia split up into all kinds of tiny little
right.
countries and everywhere else as well, that we forget that those populations were always mixed.
There was a sense of cosmopolitanism. I mean, people like Einstein, Albert Einstein came out of the same culture, German-speaking Jew from the East.
Right.
Most of his best work is done in Berlin. And then he moved to the United States.
And who also said that nationalism was the measles of mankind,
great.
Which I think is a great quote. I'm speaking with Kevin Anderson, and you're listening to KPFK Los Angeles 90.7 FM. The program's Beneath the Surface, and I'm Susie Wiseman. We're talking about Rosa Luxemburg. Kevin has just brought out by Monthly Review Press, along with Peter Hudis, the Rosa Luxemburg Reader. And it includes not only some of Rosa Luxemburg's better-known writings, but things that have never really appeared in English before. It's something that anybody who cares about genuine democracy, which includes, you know, economic democracy, will find invaluable for the century that we're just beginning. I want to turn to one other area, and that is you know, you mentioned this earlier, but Rosa Luxemburg was, if not equal, maybe even at a higher level of talent, erudition, and theoretical prowess as Lenin and Trotsky, and could even be compared to Marx and Engels. But here she is, a woman at a time, you know, before women had the vote in the United States and Britain, and before, you know, any significant women's liberation movement. And I just wondered, you know, how much that's affected how well she is known and what it meant to her as well.
Well, there was a large women's movement at the time in both the United States and Germany. In Germany, unlike the U.S., there were two women's movements, both of them pretty large. There was one that was more similar to the U.S. that was a liberal women's movement. And then there was a very large socialist women's movement. Luxembourg's best personal friend, Clara Zetkin, was the leader of the German socialist women's movement, which was also, in a way, the lead of any of these. Germany was the center of the worldwide socialist women's movement at that time. They had a weekly newspaper that circulated, I think, about 50 or 100,000 copies. This was no small group. And Luxemburg didn't write a lot directly on women's issues, although we have the articles translated.
But she also didn't want to be ghettoized as a woman, right?
It was that kind of thing. I mean, today I guess it still comes up in certain contexts, but very much for Luxemburg, one gets the feeling, as you're saying, that she didn't want to become the leader of the women's movement, which is like, these women's groups were considered like almost like the women's auxiliary.
Mm-hmm.
She wanted to become part of the central leadership from very, very young. I mean, that piece I mentioned she wrote in 1899, she hadn't turned 30 years old yet.
On reform and revolution.
Yeah. And that is because reformist socialism had just come onto the scene at that time, saying that socialists should work through parliamentary ministries and gradual change rather than revolutionary change. She gives the best received answer from the revolutionary side in any language, not just German. And she wasn't the only one who was trying to answer these people, believe me. There were like dozens and dozens who were answering and debating on both sides. But at the time of this, her late 20s, she comes onto the scene. And that's where these arguments about militarism and war start as well.
And would you say that she had or I don't know if you can say this, did she have a positive influence on Lenin at all? I know they had sharp disagreements, but they certainly had a, you know, give-and-take kind of relationship in their arguments.
I think they very much influence each other. I think that there was also a certain distance where, I mean, Rodionievskaya, who wrote a book on Luxembourg, speculated that gender might have even played a role in, like, this distancing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the male leaders, I mean, in one sense, you have to compliment them, because when there was no other, I don't think the Republican Party, the Democratic Party in the United States had among their top three or four leaders a woman at that time.
No.
I mean, nowhere even near. So you have to compliment the Socialists and the Socialist International for that, with a big but, which is that there's a lot of distancing, there's a lot of, and in private, as we were discussing before the program started, there's a lot of private innuendo and really viciousness.
Right.
Toward her.
Well, and then, you know, it's kind of difficult to ask people to be abstracted from their time. And it wasn't a time when there was, you know, even though there was a large women's movement for equality and for suffrage, it wasn't like, you know, the advances. They were fighting for the advances that we now take for granted.
Right. I mean, part of the socialist program was to fight for women's suffrage, which did not exist. In fact, universal suffrage didn't exist in a lot of countries.
Well, Kevin, I want to go over something that Rosa Luxemburg took on, the really meaty theoretical issues about the nature of the capitalist accumulation
right.
and the economy. And this is really hard to do on radio. But
we have to do it because
yeah.
this is not someone who is a lot of people are celebrated because they were brave, they were revolutionary, they were killed for their beliefs.
They were poetic, you know.
She's all of those, but she's also a very, very serious thinker on political economy, on politics and other ways, on revolutionary movements. And it's not simply a defense of these or anything like that, or her putting her life with her ideas, but it's really serious theoretical contributions.
Well, I don't want to go into the whole debate about expanded reproduction and, you know, that we find in the second volume of Capital, but and I don't think our listeners could do it either, but maybe, you know, the harshest critique that you hear from, let's say, orthodox Marxists is that she believed mm-hmm. that capitalism would inevitably collapse. Is that the case, and is that what she says?
She believed it would inevitably collapse. But the reasons that she gave were a little different than some others gave, in that she gave a huge, and this is part of why she's popular today, especially in a lot of non-Western societies, like places like India. Luxembourg is read. There was a Luxembourg conference in China about a month ago that was very well attended. Part of the reason is that she devotes a lot of space in her economic analysis to the way that capitalism operated in places like India, China, North Africa, and South Africa were four that she wrote about. And from Luxembourg's standpoint, capitalistic exploitation and really robbery of non-European societies has a far greater importance than it did to Marx himself in terms of where capitalism gets its wealth.
And this is sort of in the early stages of imperialism.
Well, it's more than the early stages. I mean, she's right there as the word imperialism is being coined to describe this carving up of Africa, Asia, and so forth. There's two or three books written in the early 20th century about imperialism, and her book, Accumulation of Capital, which in the English translation they don't give the subtitle. The subtitle is A Contribution to the Explanation of Imperialism. This is what the book was about. So all the analysis of expanded reproduction and this kind of stuff, very technical stuff, on Volume 2 of Capital is leading up to a certain kind of very original interpretation of imperialism.
Well, looking at what's going on in the world today, you know, with the end of the Soviet Union and with the United States as the imperial power and with even the publication, as you mentioned, of Tony Negri and Michael Hart's book on empire and
right.
all of the controversy over the nature of this new imperialism, where would you put Rosa Luxemburg in this debate?
Well, Rosa Luxemburg, I don't think you can write about imperialism without being indebted to Rosa Luxemburg. I think when people don't know who Rosa Luxemburg is, it doesn't mean that they're not using her ideas, because they're just really part of the fabric of the way that we talk about imperialism and globalization. For example, thinkers like Emmanuel Wallerstein, who's a more of an academic radical, I see a tremendous whether direct or indirect influence from Rosa Luxemburg, there I think it's probably, I'm sure the authors of Empire are quite aware of Luxemburg's work. I can't recall if they refer to Luxemburg in that book, or if they do, it's not at any great length. But it's something that people need to look at, I would think, because imperialism has a history, and globalized capitalism in the present form is a little different, but I think it's very good to look at the earlier forms of globalization. And also, they may have had some ideas about how to resist it that maybe
worth borrowing, that we
could learn from.
I'm speaking with Kevin Anderson, and he and Peter Hudis have just brought out the Rosa Luxemburg Reader by Monthly Review Press. And we're talking about Rosa Luxemburg's legacy and her theoretical thought and some of the things that appear in this book. You're listening to Beneath the Surface, and I'm Susie Wiseman. And, you know, Kevin, this is these arguments that you're bringing up about the subtext, let's say even the subtitle of her work on the accumulation of capital, in terms of understanding imperialism, are really important. But going back to the idea that capitalism would collapse, I remember having this discussion with Daniel Singer on one of his many trips here, and he said, you know, capitalism is on the precipice, but it needs a workers' movement to push it over. It won't just collapse of its own. It's got a kind of dynamism and resiliency to find new ways to continue. And perhaps Rosa couldn't have seen that at the time, but what do you think she would say about that aspect today, or is it fair for me to even ask you that?
Well, I think she anticipated a lot of the arguments of the ecologists, people like that, even though she didn't write about ecology specifically, which is that normal capitalism without a revolution, without any kind of political disruption, is just heading over the cliff. In other words, that it could end in some kind of just barbaric chaos, okay, some kind of dystopia, or there could be the possibility of a humanistic radical transformation that would be a grassroots democracy that would be socialistic, so forth. But she really saw, probably, I think, because of this angle of war and militarism and writing in the middle of World War I, she was breaking with another concept that a lot of orthodox Marxists had, which is the notion of progress. That she wasn't so sure that by the middle of World War I, she was no longer so sure that progress was really necessarily going to take place. So
this puts her at odds with most Marxists, doesn't
definitely.
It?
Definitely. And with the whole thing that Marxism is often criticized for being a prisoner of Enlightenment, mm-hmm. progressivist Enlightenment thinking.
And so linear forth. Thinking, too, perhaps.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's really interesting. So,
In fact, our mutual friend, Michel Loewy, the French Marxist thinker, is one of the people who in his work has given a lot of emphasis to Luxembourg's critique of progressivism.
And what would you say, because we don't have oodles of time left, Kevin, that, I mean, we're talking about her legacy, but thinking in particular about her place in history and what she has to say for the next century, what would you say? And I know that you may even want to read a few things in the book.
Well, in terms of her place in history, I just want to underline one thing about her life, which is that this is someone who was both an activist and a thinker, actually a political leader and a thinker. I mean, we have a lot of leaders in this country, and if they write a book, you kind of know that, like, someone else really wrote it for them, usually.
And they're pretty thin.
And yeah, and then you read them, and, you know. But this is someone who would be one of the major political theorists of the 20th century, but also an important political leader. And that kind of combination is just very unusual. One of the reasons it could happen is because people like Luxemburg could never become professors at universities at the time. Not until the 1920s was it possible for a Marxist to teach at universities in Western Europe, let alone the United States. This is a very different type of personality than we're used to in the political world of today. This is someone was just a very interesting human being. As you were mentioning, I think before we started the program, some of the letters. I mean, one
her
of the
letters
reasons,
are beautiful.
She's best known, I would say, for her letters, and the letters are literary masterpieces. But they also have some very interesting political content he goes back to Greek mythology, and the women's position in Greek society, not only in the society itself, but how it was alluded to in mythology, and the possibility that maybe there had been stronger women further back in the past before we started getting to the era of history and so forth. She alludes to some of that as a possible seed for opposition to war. She sees women as very crucial to the opposition to war.
Right, back to Lysistrata.
And all that kind of thing. Yeah, exactly.
Well, we're running out of time, and I know that one of the things that, in speaking about not only, the force of her writings and of her thought, Daniel Singer always used to say, and quote, and it is his epitaph as well as hers in a way. She says, "Your order is built on sand. The revolution will raise itself up again, clashing, and to your horror, it will proclaim to the sound of trumpets, I was, I am, I will be." And I think this is not just for Rosa, but this is for the revolution.
Yeah, and this is for kind of a missed moment in German history that, as you're saying at the beginning, we can't assume that just because Hitler was around at that time and was developing his philosophy of hate, and believe me, when he talked about the stab in the back that supposedly made Germany defeat in the war, Rosa Luxemburg was probably at the top of his list of who he specifically had in mind when he was talking about that.
And it turns out that it was the social democratic misleaders who killed her, not Hitler.
Well, actually, they had power in the government, but the people who carried it out were these off-duty soldiers, kind of similar to a Latin American death squad.
Right, right. Well, we've run out of time, but I think we've touched on a lot of the major aspects, and I just want to thank you for joining me in studio today, Kevin Anderson.
Thank you very much.
Kevin teaches at Purdue, and he also has edited several other editions, including Lenin, Hegel, and Western Marxism, and the huge thing that we talked about a year ago, the Marx Engels works and Marx on Suicide. But this book with Peter Hudis is called The Rosa Luxemburg Reader, and it is just out by Monthly Review Press. And I want to thank you for joining us, and good luck with this
book. Thank you very much for inviting me.
And you're listening to Beneath the Surface on KPFK Los Angeles.